I next met with Dr. Andrew Zhu, who chatted with me about hepatocellular cancer, beginning with a paper he co-authored in the journal Cancer in December on the potential etiologic connection with metabolic syndrome.
This is an area, I think, as a field, we should continue to make more efforts to understand the potential correlation between diabetes mellitus, obesity, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, NASH, with the potential increased risk for hepatocellular carcinoma. I think from the epidemiological perspective, there seems to be a correlation between this whole class of syndrome with the development of hepatocellular carcinoma. But on the other hand, I don't think we have enough data to say to what extent that this has really increased the risk for hepatocellular carcinoma. In my practice, as a very busy medical oncologist taking care of a lot of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, I think this entity may be real. What I mean by that is I see a lot of patients walk into my door. They have no typical risk factors for hepatocellular carcinoma. These are the patients who have the healthiest lifestyle. They don't have any alcohol intake, no hepatitis B or C serology, no family history for rare metabolic genetic disorders for liver disease, but they develop hepatocellular carcinoma. Some of them, we were able to actually assess the pathology of their liver because when we do the biopsy of the hepatocellular carcinoma, sometimes we can actually get some surrounding normal liver. We can get a sense that the surrounding normal liver may actually have some fibrosis, maybe related to steatohepatitis. But most of them, the biopsy actually was exclusively from the HCC itself. So we were actually not sure they actually fall into the category of NASH or diabetes. But a lot of patients do have the increased MI in this setting. So their BMI probably is in the 30 or 35 range or even higher. So my personal feeling is that this end correlation may be real, but I'm not sure exactly what magnitude of the increased risk that this syndrome is really contributing to the HCC, because this is really a very common metabolic syndrome that's affecting so many patients in the Western world. So if you really have the association, I think any small shift of the association will lead to a very important epidemiology trend shift. I think the association is right there, but to what extent this association is really manifesting itself, I think remains to be defined in the coming decade, in my opinion.
Let's discuss the one new novel agent that has come out in HCC, sorafenib.
Personally, I give a lot of credits to the development of sorafenib because I think for a long time, we absolutely have no drugs that we can actually say with confidence the drug is working in HCC. So I think with the development of sorafenib, we actually as a field, for the first time, we can say, look, if you give this multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor to patients who are not candidate for surgical resection, who can go through transarterial chemoembolization, you can actually improve the overall survival. The randomized phase 3 SHARP study clearly demonstrated that the improved overall survival is definitely there. But I think, you know, the challenge, as we're using the drug for the past 2 to 3 years, I think the challenge all of a sudden is actually facing the community even more because we have more questions that's actually never answered before. How the drug is working, what mechanism of the sorafenib that actually mediate the clinical benefit. We know this is a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor, and the targets includes the VEGFR, the PDGFR, and potentially maybe the RAF kinase as well. Whether this is through inhibition of any of the targets that this drug's supposed to hit, or actually this is off-target inhibition of some unidentified targets, we actually have very limited information. Overall, we think that inhibiting the angiogenesis pathway is probably a very effective therapeutic pathway based on the data of sorafenib and also some early data based on the phase 2 studies of a few target agents being developed at this point. If you really examine what's in common in these agents that seem to have some early moderate to modest activity, I think antiangiogenesis probably seems to be the shared mechanism of action of these drugs. But we actually do not know how sorafenib is really working in HCC patients. In the initial phase 2 study of sorafenib in HCC, very interestingly, of the 137 patients enrolled in that study, they were able to retrieve approximately 30 patients of their tumor blocks. They look at the baseline archive tissue for the phosphorylated ERK expression. And so based on the intensity of the ERK expression, they were able to separate the groups who have baseline higher pERK level versus those who have lower pERK level in their tumor blocks. And you were able to separate the time to tumor progression among these patients. So those who have baseline higher phosphorylated ERK level, they seem to have longer time to tumor progression, arguing that maybe this pathway is relevant to predict the sorafenib activity. To support this hypothesis, there are some in vitro studies. If you look at cell lines and look at that phosphorylated ERK level, so you can get a bunch of different HCC cell lines. You can actually assess their baseline phosphorylated ERK level. And those who have higher level seem to actually respond to the sorafenib inhibition in vitro more potently. But again, in the in vivo setting, we don't know whether this is really panning out. And also in the SHARP study, we have not actually seen the definitive data coming out that validating baseline ERK is a predictive marker for this particular drug.
What exactly is ERK? What's the pathway or what is it?
So it's very interesting. If you look at the network of the cancer cells, we know there are multiple pathways involved. But I think there are actually a few key pathways that seem to be consistently activated based on the extracellular signal that's actually hitting the cell surface receptors. And one of the pathways is really through the RAS, RAF, MEK, and then ERK pathway. So this is actually a vertical signal transduction pathway that the cells has evolved to transmit signals from the cell surface receptors. In this case, the epidermal growth factor receptor use this pathway. The insulin growth factor receptor use this pathway. And there are a few other growth factors using the same pathway. So this is actually a very important pathway that actually transmits the signal from the cell surface receptor all the way down to the nucleus. So for the cell to proliferate, this key pathway has to be activated sequentially. But in cancer cells, this pathway is even more important because we have a lot of evidence that this pathway, they either get preferentially activated or they have genetic mutations so that they actually have the constitutive activation. So this pathway clearly is very important in cancer cells.
You mentioned angiogenesis. What do we know about BEV and HCC?
Angiogenesis is definitely gaining increased attention in development of anti-cancer treatment strategy. For hepatocellular carcinoma, I definitely think this is a relevant target for several reasons. Clinically, you can appreciate that HCC is definitely a very vascular tumor. We see that all the times by the routine imaging. When the clinician requests a CT scan to look for HCC, if you really have this particular suspicion, you should specify the patient getting the so-called triphasic CT scan, meaning they have to actually capture the contrast retention in the arterial phase, because these lesions are incredibly arterially enhancing if you catch it early. When the interventional radiologist is doing the angiogram, you can appreciate that the hepatocellular carcinoma is very rich in the blood vessel supply. So clinically, we know this is a very vascular tumor. If you examine all the relevant angiogenesis markers, be it VEGF, VEGFR, microvessel density in the tumor sample itself, and definitely you appreciate the increased activation of these angiogenesis markers in hepatocellular carcinoma. If you try to see whether these markers have any relevance in the real clinical setting, for example, examine the baseline VEGF level for those who undergo surgical resection, the data seem to be suggesting those with higher VEGF level at baseline, their prognosis following surgical resection is definitely inferior. And also, there are a lot of parallel studies looking at the outcome in the post-TACE setting, in the post-radiofrequency ablation setting. The data seems to be panning out. Activated angiogenesis marker seems to be correlating with inferior treatment outcome in several settings. So that's why I think the development of anti-angiogenic therapies in HCC, I think, really represent a viable approach. But I think there are a lot of challenges, though. What I mean by that is that we don't know exactly, of all the angiogenesis pathway, which particular molecule is really very critical for therapeutic intervention. the field right now is focusing on the VEGF and VEGFR axis because that's the axis that we have more drugs that we can target. But keep in mind, that's only one of the major molecules in the whole field. We do have other molecules in the angiogenesis pathway. And the relevance for therapeutic intervention in HCC remains to be defined. We don't know to what extent just by inhibiting the angiogenesis pathway, we can achieve the tumor inhibition. Even with sorafenib, even though the clinical benefit is real, but the benefit is really modest to moderate at best. I don't think right now we can say, look, even with sorafenib, we have achieved the clinical benefit that we all desire. There is a long way that we can actually improve. So it really raises the question, to what extent that we can actually really expect a potent anti-angiogenic agent can really achieve the anti-HCC activity? What combination strategy we can actually combine with the anti-angiogenic agents to achieve even improved anti-HCC efficacy? What's the resistance mechanism for those who just absolutely don't benefit from this approach, or for those who actually have the acquired resistance, meaning they may initially respond to the sorafenib, but after a while, they still progress? These questions, we have very limited information at this point.
What about bevacizumab specifically in HCC? What do we know about it?
So this is a very interesting drug in hepatocellular carcinoma. The development of bevacizumab probably has the longest history in HCC. There are actually quite a few phase 2 studies going into HCC, testing bevacizumab either alone at different dosage or actually in combination with either chemotherapy backbone or actually with another target agent. I think collectively speaking, all these small phase 2 studies seem to suggest that bevacizumab has some activity in hepatocellular carcinoma. There are actually two phase 2 studies looking at bevacizumab alone as a single agent, showing some very reasonable single agent activity in terms of progression-free survival and even some modest response rate. And also the combination with bevacizumab with chemotherapy has reasonable respected phase 2 data. The most perplexing data is probably the combination of bevacizumab with erlotinib, an EGFR inhibitor, in a phase 2 study conducted at MD Anderson, reported on JCO last year. The response rate was actually as high as 25% and progression-free survival 9 months. Now, this is really incredibly good results, but you have to realize this is the study that's actually conducted in a single center, in a single arm. So there's always this worry that when you do the single-arm phase 2 study, the patient selection bias probably will influence the outcome in the single-arm study. So unfortunately, right now, there's really no plan to further develop bevacizumab as a therapeutic agent in HCC. So I'm not aware of any registration study right now looking at bevacizumab in HCC, which is really unfortunate. But I do want to caution the use of bevacizumab in HCC just because of the safety issues. We know that bevacizumab can cause bleeding, hypertension, thromboembolic events. For hepatocellular carcinoma, this is a very tough population to use anti-angiogenic agents. As you know, a lot of these patients with underlying cirrhosis with resulting esophageal varices. So they're very prone for bleeding. In the phase 2 studies with bevacizumab, bleeding has been actually a challenge. In almost all the studies, there were a few bleeding events reported in the single-arm phase 2 studies. So I think this class of agents, even though they're showing some efficacy, I think, you know, we should continue to be very cautious how to optimize the efficacy and minimizing the treatment-related toxicity, particularly for bleeding risk and also for hepatic encephalopathy.
What do we know about the use of systemic therapy, specifically sorafenib, in the adjuvant setting after surgical resection, after transplant, and after TACE? What's been looked at and what's being looked at?
Yeah, this is a very important question. We're actually addressing these questions through clinical trials. I think the successful development of sorafenib in the advanced disease setting really begs the question whether we can move this drug in the earliest disease stage settings. As you know, there is actually an ongoing international study looking at sorafenib versus placebo for patients who underwent successful surgical resection or who have either intermediate or high-risk radiofrequency ablation. So these are actually a very important study to address the question, if you use sorafenib in the adjuvant setting, whether you can improve the outcome for patients who underwent surgical resection or radiofrequency ablation. You know, unfortunately, this study probably would take quite a few more years before we actually know the data. So until then, we still don't know whether an agent like sorafenib, if you use it in the adjuvant setting, you can actually improve the outcome. But I think this is a very important question. As a community, I think we should continue to support the completion of the important ongoing clinical trial. Now, following the transarterial chemoembolization, there are actually quite a few studies being conducted right now to look at this specific question. But there are actually several questions in the TACE setting. You can actually examine the concurrent administration of TACE using sorafenib at the same time, or you can actually introduce sorafenib after TACE so that the question is more or less like in the adjuvant setting to see whether the use of sorafenib following TACE will either decrease the use of repeated TACE or actually prolong the time to tumor progression and also improve survival. So these are actually different trial designs to address the issue of sorafenib in the TACE setting. Suffice to say right now, all the important trials are actually still ongoing. I don't think we have any definitive data showing that if you use sorafenib in this setting, you actually improve the outcome from what we already achieved from the conventional local treatments.
What about post-transplant?
So there's really no data in the post-transplant setting at this point. Doing an adjuvant study in the post-transplant setting is quite challenging. If you stick to the typical transplant criteria, for example, the Milan criteria, the outcome is very favorable already. We have 4-year disease-free rate, maybe in the neighborhood of 75% if you stick to the criteria. So to demonstrate that the drug can even improve the outcome from 75% to 80% really requires a very incredible sample size to demonstrate that. So I think logistically speaking, I don't think we can design a study, to be honest with you, to demonstrate this one very easily. So I think in the transplant setting, people are using this approach in the highly selected patient population. For example, if patients actually have macrovascular invasion, we know those patients, even they actually undergo transplant, their risk of recurrence is actually high. So there are actually small studies looking at that setting at this point.
How do you approach the issue of dose schedule and reduction in dose and toxicity in patients with hepatic dysfunction and older patients?
This is a very, very important question in clinical practice because, as you know, the SHARP study was really looking for patients who have preserved underlying hepatic function, i.e. those patients with underlying Child-Pugh A cirrhosis. So both the efficacy as well as the toxicity profiles were actually demonstrated in that very highly selected superstar patient population. However, in reality, we're probably seeing about a quarter of patients with child A cirrhosis, maybe another quarter with child B, maybe another 30% with child C. We actually have very limited data how to use sorafenib for patients with worsening hepatic dysfunction. For patients with underlying child C cirrhosis, I think you should not even consider offering sorafenib to these patients because, in my opinion, the field probably reached the agreement that these patients, they probably will succumb to the underlying cirrhosis. So the HCC may not be the real issue in that particular setting. The controversy is really surrounding the patients with the underlying child B cirrhosis and whether we should give the drug to these patients. And if we do, how do we actually dose reduce these patients? Again, the data is by far very, very convincing right now. We have some retrospective data showing that if you give sorafenib in patients with child B cirrhosis, the toxicity profile is probably comparable with the exception that hyperbilirubinemia is definitely more pronounced if you have patients with child B cirrhosis. But the rest of the toxicity profile seems to be very comparable. We think that the pharmacokinetic profiles for patients with child A versus B probably is also very comparable. But on the other hand, there are also data showing that if you have underlying child B cirrhosis, you may want to dose reduce these patients upfront just because of the pharmacokinetic profiles. I think the bottom line is how much benefit that we're expecting from patients with underlying child B cirrhosis. I think the data seems to suggest that those who already have the underlying child B cirrhosis, I think they will do definitely worse compared with those who have underlying Child-Aid cirrhosis. So the benefit from sorafenib is probably not as pronounced as the Child-Aid population, but there's absolutely no prospective data looking at this population to really highlight the relative benefit of giving sorafenib in that setting versus the placebo right now.
What about the older patient, 85, 90, early 90s?
Yeah. So this is a very, very interesting question that I personally have a lot of interest. I think in the oncology field, we start to appreciate that we should definitely not discriminate patients based on age itself. We should continue to use the functional performance status as our best criteria to select these patients. I think if a very robust 80 years old gentleman walk into my clinic without any underlying comorbid conditions, probably I should not use the age itself to dose reduce it. I think if the patient has underlying preserved hepatic function, child A, very excellent performance status, we should probably dose this patient the same way if we dose a 60-year-old gentleman. This should be actually probably the standard message. But on the other hand, we do have to use common sense in our clinical practice. If a 90 years old barely can walk into the door, a lot of comorbid condition, compromised renal hepatic function due to other reasons, I think in that setting, I should be very cautious giving the sorafenib in the first place. If I do want to offer the sorafenib, I may want to cut down the dose to begin with. If the patient can tolerate the initial challenge, I think I'm happy to increase the dose afterwards. But I should definitely take a very cautious approach.
What have you observed in terms of the hand-foot syndrome that's seen with sorafenib? Do you do anything other than dose modification, any creams or local therapies?
Of all the side effects encountered with sorafenib, perhaps the hand-foot skin reaction is probably the most challenging one to deal with. In that particular case, I personally think vigilant monitoring probably by far is the best strategy. So I have not encountered any patients who develop uncontrollable hand and foot skin reaction overnight. So in other words, if you see these patients very regularly and also more frequently during the initial couple of weeks, you can start to appreciate that it's coming. The hand foot skin reaction is starting to appear. You should actually raise the red flag either to start to dose reduce or hold the treatment, but more importantly, probably to have some intervention. Obviously, with skin creams, with all these topical creams, try to decrease the inflammation. Try to make sure they use the moisturizers very carefully. Try to make sure they're not wearing the shoes very tightly. With these very meticulous skin care, you can make sure that they can get the adequate dose maybe a little bit longer. And B, if they do have trouble, you can actually reduce the dose or even holding the treatment very timely so that they don't develop to the very nasty grade 3 or higher hand-foot skin reaction. So again, very high vigilance, close monitoring, and early intervention with very aggressive skin care is the main message.
So why don't we talk about one of your patients? How about this 65-year-old man?
It's a very, very typical scenario. This is a real scenario. Patients actually presents to my office with increased right upper quadrant pain and also some dyspnea and exertion. After the initial evaluation, the imaging was performed, which really showed multifocal arterial enhancing lesion in the liver bilobar. In addition, the chest CT scan also demonstrated multiple pulmonary nodules with enlarged mediastinal lymphadenopathy. This patient does have hepatitis C history. His alpha fetal protein level was actually not that impressive in the sense that it's only in the 100 range. So for this reason that the biopsy was actually obtained before coming to see me, just to be on the cautious side, which demonstrated moderately differentiated hepatocellular carcinoma. His performance status is good. It was 1. Based on all the laboratory investigation, including chemistry, liver function tests, and also clinical assessment, his albumin was 3.8, total bilirubin 1.4. He had no ascites. He has no encephalopathy. So his underlying cirrhosis definitely falling into the category of Child-Pugh A. When I see this kind of patient, clearly this would not be the patient that you would think about definitive surgical resection or transplant. And also because the patient has definitely radiographic evidence of extrahepatic disease, in this case pulmonary metastasis and lymphadenopathy, this is not the kind of patient that you would consider local treatment modality, particularly transarterial chemoembolization. So this will be actually the typical patient that you will actually consider systemic therapy as the initial treatment modality. If you have a clinical trial right now looking at a very interesting study to address the question whether you have a drug that you think will actually be reasonably compared with sorafenib, or actually this is actually a trial looking at a specific combination with sorafenib, I think this patient may actually be a good candidate to participate in that trial. But if you don't have the accessibility to participate in this kind of clinical trial, I think offering this patient with sorafenib will be the standard of the treatment at this point.
So what actually happened with this man?
So this is actually a very interesting patient. This patient actually, with the treatment, he did very well during the first 2 months. And we actually started with full dosage, i.e. 400 milligram BID. He started to have some mild fatigue during the second month. The first month, actually, he sailed through very nicely. He started to have some very mild erythema in his palms, and so we instituted in a very aggressive topical skincare. We did not actually dose reduce him during the first 2 cycles, so he was able to get the full dosage during the first 2 cycles. And on a follow-up CT scan, he actually demonstrated that he had multiple small pulmonary nodules that actually decreasing in size. And the hepatic lesions are actually relatively stable, but you can appreciate some tumor necrosis in a few lesions. His AFP was actually also trending down. But during the subsequent cycles, we had to actually cut down the dosage to 400 milligram daily, 50% dose reduction because of the worsening hand and foot skin reaction. But he continued to be on the treatment right now, probably in the 6 cycles right now. He's still taking the sorafenib 400 milligram daily, 50% of the initial dose.
What's his quality of life and how does he spend his time?
Very good. Actually, very good. This particular gentleman actually is enjoying good quality of life. While he was on study, he actually took 2 family vacations with his wife. And during the vacation, he didn't even interrupt the treatment. So this is actually a nice story, getting the right treatment, actually benefit from the treatment and not interfering with the underlying quality of life.
How often do you see extrahepatic lesions at diagnosis like this, and particularly how often do you see mediastinal nodes as he had?
In my practice, obviously, I'm a medical oncologist. I see a lot of the patients who are already actually being evaluated by the surgeons, by the hepatologists. So obviously, those patients with early stage or intermediate stage of disease probably got evaluated by those caregivers. So I do see a higher percentage of the patients with extrahepatic disease. The pattern of metastasis in HCC is actually very interesting. Essentially, we see all the patterns of metastatic disease. The tumor definitely can metastasize to the lymph nodes, to the lung, to the bones. And recently, I actually have a few cases, patient actually present with brain mets. So I'm pretty sure that if we actually keep developing effective target agents or systemic chemotherapy in this disease, we may actually shift the metastatic disease pattern as we experience with other tumor types. But I think lung metastasis, mediastinum, lymph nodes, definitely very common in my practice. I probably see about 20% of the patient with this kind of manifestation.
We had a CME meeting at the ASCO GI meeting recently, and one of the docs in practice from Illinois presented a couple of patients with HCC who'd been on sorafenib for 2 years. And I was really surprised because I didn't know that you saw those kinds of duration of treatment. This man's now been on treatment 6 months. What's the spectrum of what you see in terms of duration of treatment? Do you see people going out 1 or 2 years?
No, I think those who actually got the treatment for 2 years is definitely on the exceptional side. As we actually approved sorafenib 2 years ago in this country, I think the experience is actually starting to accumulate. I must say that the medium duration of treatment for sorafenib is definitely not on the long side, in my opinion, partly because of the tolerability issue, whether these patients just can't tolerate or actually we did not manage the treatment-related side effects very timely or efficiently, or just the inherent aggressive nature of the disease that the patient just won't benefit from sorafenib. I don't think the medium duration on drug is actually on the longer side. If I have to really guess, I probably will say that the medium is probably in the neighborhood of anywhere between 3 to 6 months. I think the main message I still want to leave to the community is that as much as we have a lot of excitement for the development of target agents in this disease, we have to keep in mind that the benefit that we're achieving with these new target agents are actually moderate at best at this point. And also, the toxicity is not trivial. The cost is absolutely astronomical. So as much as me as a medical oncologist, I continue to share the enthusiasm to devote my research in this area to develop additional target agents, we have to keep in mind that we should actually continue our efforts in the prevention, in the early diagnosis, in the screening strategy, so that we can actually shift the disease diagnosis to the early stage. Because if we can achieve that, we actually make a huge difference for the outcome of these patients. But coming back to what kind of challenge that we're facing, you know, with the target agent development, I still think that we need to understand more in terms of how these drugs work. Also, to be able to select the patient who is likely to benefit, who is likely to be able to be spared from the treatment-related toxicity. I think, you know, all these are very, very relevant questions. In terms of dosing, I do get a lot of questions about dosing sorafenib. I think you have to use the clinical wisdom in this setting. You have to assess the individual patients based on their performance status, the underlying hepatic function, or the underlying comorbid condition. If you're really concerned whether the patient can tolerate or not, going in with a relatively dose reduction with a very quick follow-up to make sure the patient definitely tolerate, and then you can dose escalate to the full dosage if they can tolerate the initial challenge, it's a reasonable strategy. I would definitely discourage the routine use of sorafenib in the post-transplant setting, in the post-resection setting, outside of the clinical trial setting, because I think as a community, we should continue to support to really invite these patients to participate in the clinical trials so that we can actually really utilize the resources very wisely to be able to answer these questions logically so that 10 years from now on, we can actually move the field stepwise, but on the other hand, in the right direction.